This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Arthur Kwan Lee. He's an artist. Arthur, great talking to you.
Thank you for having me on, Robert. I appreciate it.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Arthur. Glad to be on.
Arthur, can you talk about how you got into art? I mean, I'm an artist myself, and I've been painting for about 15 years, but I've just kind of just started with the whole gallery scene. Can you talk about your background as an artist and how long have you been painting?
So I am a Korean-American painter, and recently I've been coined as a social critic who produces work out of Washington, D.C. in my studio in Adams Morgan. Along with just being in the arts has been a whole... I'm essentially constantly in the arts. I'm also an educator running programs for experiential education for the metropolitan community through a number of respected organizations. And my whole association with the arts came from the fact that if you look at, you know, typical Korean culture, what you'll see is that, you know, they want you to practice the arts more as a, you know, side vocation. They don't really want you to become a professional artist per se. But what happened was, I was winning awards and I was...
Are you talking about in Korea or the Korean community in America?
The whole Korean culture in general, they have this notion of, you know, typical, you know, they want you to either become a doctor or a lawyer or something that has a, you know, higher income generally. And that's what you're supposed to progress towards. But my passion was in painting. So what I did actually, and this is a funny story, is there was this art contest. This is when there was a high school art contest, and I was only 14 at that time. And what I did is I lied about my age and entered. Uh-huh. And then they announced the winner to the whole public already, so they couldn't take it back. So when I showed up as this, you know, middle schooler, they had to give me the reward nonetheless. And just doing some, you know, in a way gangster kind of things like that, you know, they kind of got the point that, all right, this guy's, you know, gonna do what he's gonna do. So my parents then supported me, and that's when I went to GW and got my fine arts degree.
You kind of mixed together your art and political philosophy on your art website. I sort of, like, I have my main website where I have, like, political guest and a cultural guest, and I link to my art page on Facebook, but I also have a separate art site. I mean, I'm sort of keeping it separate to a degree, but I mean, obviously, if people look up my information, they'll be able to find it all. You actually have an art website, and you also you kind of consolidate your artwork and your political and philosophical views all on one site, including your podcast.
Well, you have to, in a way, because what happens is, look, while I'm, you know, very financially comfortable on one hand as an artist, which is difficult, I'm also the black sheep amongst the DC art community for, in a way, and this might sound humorous, but on the real side, mind you, it's for not being an overweight, Hillary-loving, LGBTQRSTUV WXYZ, tranny, crossfitting, vegan, social justice warrior, paper. You see what I'm saying? It's just like,
yeah,
for not being, not falling into the leftist indoctrination of identity politics that is run by, in the gallery scene, is run by leftist thinking. It's really atypical to be a conservative artist. And to take that position, in a way, is the rebel thing to do. So if we're discussing about the highs and lows of visual thinking, and what's to ask the average 9-to-5 Joe to define the premise of art, he would probably tell me it's about beauty or capturing transient emotions. You see what I'm saying? It's a still moment. But while that is all true, you know, postmodern art has become a situation where it's a creative expression in the lens of language. And what I mean by that is art is not necessarily about beauty, but about language. And while I usually find any of like this postmodern stuff to be kind of distasteful because it lacks structural integrity. That's what I call it. Because they're not grounded in fundamentals. There are, in a way, political origins for this. And that's why I go into this political dimension. Because the highest form of art, in many sense, is social criticism. Because the artist is commenting on the ebb and flows of culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm also consider myself a social critic. When I do a painting, I don't go out of my way to do a social commentary, but there's kind of, I had a kind of funny incident on Facebook because I was doing paintings of different, like I like to paint the interiors of like Las Vegas casinos, and I had some like radical traditionalist type on Facebook, like from the alt-right, say, oh, is that like a critique of like modern decadence? And I was like, no, that's just something that I find aesthetically pleasing and that kind of came to my interest that I wanted to capture.
Yeah, I mean, I listen, as an educator, I teach drawing and painting at a consistent basis. And yeah, I 100% advocate. I saw your work. I advocate that practice because the reality is, you know, I might offend some of my peers here, but most of the work today is garbage. And the reason why it is garbage, even in strong galleries that have millions of dollars going through them, you know, I was at the Hirshhorn recently and there was this deplorable installation and I can't believe it was worth $3 million. And what's come to mind is that just like anything else, any other discipline, you need to learn the rules to break them. And learning the rules basically means learning how to do a still life or paint a landscape or understand color. It might seem boring at first, but you expect us to take you seriously if you can't do these basics. And in that sense, that's why a person simply painting still life or going outside and doing plein air, that is beautiful because that is a step towards doing much more contextually deep work. Mm-hmm. And the gallery scene, mind you, I also I run a gallery with my team, and the whole function of a gallery is it is a beacon for conversations that in a way people are uncomfortable about. You know, it's a catalyst for this kind of reflection, you know? And the problem though is while that all sounds hunky-dory, today the gallery's hive mind is undeniably catered to the left in large cities like Washington, D.C., New York, L.A., and that is where the art scene is. So it's just dramatized and riddled with this virtue signaling identity politics, and that is a problem.
The same thing is also with the English major and all the English literature that's happening right now. In school, when you take quote-unquote critical literature or even deconstruction, it is so politically biased that it's quite evident that not even the professors question the political origins that happened in the 1960s in Pius, and they pretend as if it's this scientific rhetoric when in fact it is the far left. And it's so sad that
exactly.
We became so deluded that the normal person can't even see above this. And now art and literature and every possible format is a biased ideological thing. And, you know, it's weird because the alt-right is the only like movement on the internet that is lashing out against this and is basically playing the rules, but getting back to what is meaningful. Mm. And when you start to realize that there are biases and whatever, and we're in this post far left thing, then obviously, you know, you're supposed to question that or you lose trust in the academia and everything. And it's kind of hard. Like, how do you, I think it's good to learn the foundation of paint or any of the degrees like STEM, science, technology, education, and math. And I wish those things were taught in academia, but unfortunately with too many people coming in, it's not like that at all. I don't know what's going to happen in the future.
And it's sort of like what Arthur was saying about learning the fundamentals of painting. A lot of the great abstract artists, they learn to paint in a realistic style. And I can't paint in photorealism. I'm not good at drawing like people in depth either. But one thing I've noticed is when I first started out, I didn't really understand perspective. And some of my paintings had a very kind of distorted look. And I mean, that looked cool. But then I took a drawing class where I studied perspective. Even though I do distort stuff, learning those basic principles helped me a lot in my work.
Totally. Here's the thing, though. To touch base on the topic of the echo chamber that exists in the academic institution, that is really the problem. Because that's, in a sense, that's the blanket topic of everything we're talking about. They are so – they just want confirmation of their own practice to feeling this unearned do-gooder's high of reflecting this quality work. You know, when quite frankly, you know, my reputation in DC is being, you know, in a way I'm proud of this, but ruthlessly logical. Because when I come into a critique, you know, we're looking at the composition and we're looking at it based on an art historical context. There's pedagogy to everything. If you're going to just throw out the pedagogy, then you're throwing out the whole function of art. Here's the reality. Let's say you go to some symphony and the conductor comes up and he just tells them to just play a bunch of random notes. And then he looks at the crowd and demands them to look at it as bold and daring. You know, like that is absurd.
Yeah.
But what's going on is this idea of aesthetic relativity, where it's all relative. There's no good. Is there a beautiful? Well, clearly, you know, there are universal standards in everything. And what they're trying to do, or what the leftists are trying to do, because believe me, they run the gallery scene, is they're trying to make it to the point where it's all beautiful. In other words, this beautiful utopian idea, the goal justifies their ugly means. So if the art is crap, they're too busy feeling their own sense of moral indignation that they can't even reflect upon the fact that your work is breaking basic principles.
And it's kind of goes back, like, if you go back in history, it was like traditionalists were talking about, oh, this modern art is degenerate art. But now you see kind of like the people who control the art scene today, they have this kind of a narrow idea of what is art. And if you go into a lot of galleries, the stuff, it's very, a lot of it just kind of looks the same. Like I see, there's only like a small handful of artists that stand out. Your work is abstract, but you have a very unique style, which stands out. Like I also consider my style to be fairly unique as well. But a lot of art you see in your most galleries, it's kind of, I feel that it's sort of very repetitive, just sort of copying like other artists.
Yeah, there's a hit and miss thing going on, 100%. I mean, look, there's small galleries that I visit, and I go, this is wonderful work. I mean, what they're trying to say, it's just sometimes it really is just such a shame that these very deep and humble people who are trying to hit the nail on the head are getting no attention. And that happens all the time. And it just goes to show you this, you know, whoever is not on the designated victims list cannot really put work into a strong gallery, which is wild because what if the work is crap? You know, I think we should be, you know, this country's, I think the strength of it is when we're colorblind. And, you know, ironically, when we look at people just based on the quality of their work, you know, instead of, you know, fitting a statistic. You know, I've had a situation where I'm not going to name the gallery, but a gallery in D.C. wanted to have a solo for my work. And when I came in, they asked me, okay, where are you from? And I said, do you want to see my work? And what happened is they had an influx of, they had three or four Korean artists started showing that year, so they didn't want to show my work.
No, it's funny when I do art myself. I used to take fine arts and I used to do watercolors, but then I kind of dropped out of it when I, you know, was going to college just to focus on my own writing. At that time, I was, you know, learned about the whole foundation and about watercolors and about coloring. But sooner or later along that line, it became quite evident where it was basically this whole special snowflake thing was happening. Like they only want you simply because you're Korean, but it's like, oh, we have too much Koreans in here, so it's not. And they play this very strange mark. So for me, my case, you know, being, you know, half Asian too, it's this thing where it's like, well, I draw anime influenced styles of art. Well, that's already special. However, I like to draw hentai, and some of my stuff is on Baru websites. And
well, that's going to get every gallery.
And I'm like, uh-oh. And then that's the point where it's like, oh, we'll reconsider now. And then it's like, it seems like whenever...
Maybe if you started doing, like, transgender hentai, you could get a more gallery.
That is the direction to go, my man. I'm telling you.
Well, we talk about an anime called Patario. It's an old-school anime from late 70s and early 80s, and that was, like, one of the first yaoi animes, and I actually quite like that. And that's all a bunch of cross-dressing. So Robert is on the nail for that. But in no way am I advocating and saying that there should be degeneracy or some degenerate...
I'm just kidding.
I don't know. It's just, how do you...
Well, you know what? It's funny because my last series was titled as Prometheus. And it's funny because, well, to give you some context, Prometheus, as you may know, was a titan who gave the gift of flame and metallurgy to mankind from the gods. So I sort of had this overconfident vibe and gave myself this premise and attempt to, you know, shoot for the stars, get to the moon kind of thing. So the solo was titled Prometheus. Now, the work was a series of 12 large-scale Jungian masculine archetypes, because the most hated thing you can be today is a capital M man. You know, your enthusiastic energy and competitive vigor is frowned upon as excessive and illogically labeled as insecure without any legitimate argument, you know? So I painted kings, warriors, magicians, lovers, and this is after I read this author, Douglas Gillette, who's a mythologist. And then I read this book titled The War on Boys by Christina Hoff Sommers. And conversing with my good friend Janice Fiamanco, I then gained the courage to make a series of this work that is completely antithetical to the general premise of the mainstream. And, you know, knowing people would attempt to undermine the work as it is not a topic of those privileged victim class members. And when I sold this work to the gallery saying, you know, this is what I've been working on, and these are people who previously showed my work, you know, were happy to, because it did not have to do with the feminine, or it did not have to do with at that time the trend was Black Lives Matters, like all these sort of trends, because it was a work about masculinity, they did not want to show my work. I had to go out of my way, and the work is strong. You know, anybody who's honest about it, and I don't mean to sound egocentric, but my previous work that I showed in all those galleries that I visited were a lot worse. Because, I mean, they were strong work, but I have developed from that stage. So it was almost, it was because of the topic. And I found a very small private gallery that was willing to show my work, but I had to really go on the fringes. And it was, I was just surprised. As a matter of fact, during the Q&A at the opening, there was this third wave feminist who surprisingly, you know, retained herself from behaving embarrassingly belligerent and asked me if I'm all about representing the sexes accurately. What did she say? You know, why not paint men as these infantile morons who continue to destroy the planet, yada yada. It was like that kind of shit. And there's so much hate in her tone. Yeah. And the crowd was fully aware that she had just proven my point. You know, that woman in the 20s had become brainwashed by these pathologically damaged women with deep underlying daddy issues. And it's so sickening that they're like passing the karmic energy to the next generation.
Yeah.
And the whole point of, if you're really trying to be an artist, a cultural artist, is you're trying to, you know, in a way, this is what I do with my portraiture or my figurative work, is anything that's underemphasized collectively, I overemphasize it. The very fact that you're painting a figure, you're proclamating that. So I try to bring those to the surface so that people are forced to look at it. The problem is, today, it's, again, one more time, it's just the people running the galleries, they're all leftist.
Yeah.
Who are some of your artistic inspiration of different artists in the past?
There are so many. Joanne Machel for her energy, although not for her figure, just but for her mark making. Joanne Machel. I'm going to be cliche here, just because I did study his work in depth, but obviously Van Gogh. Who else do we have here? There are a lot of authors and philosophers who really hit me harder to produce work in that sense, though. If we're thinking in that light, people like G.K. Chesterton, Schopenhauer, Carl Jung. These are men who thought very visually. And but here's the thing. I mean, all these artists, all these thinkers, they're all sort of going in that direction of that which is being suppressed. The artist is the person who, by proclaiming himself to be an artist, is going to, you know, put it out there, you know, put it right on the table. But definitely, John Mitchell, in terms of color, Hans Hoffman's color usage, and in terms of, I'm not gonna let go of the figure. That's my human chauvinism talking. I gotta paint the figure. You know, it's a fascinating thing. So, and I think that has to do with all the figure artists that, I mean, I can go into it. It's both of the Koonings, both Elaine and Willem. And then I'm cliche with Van Gogh. I think he's amazing.
Think about the whole debate between dichotomy between modernism and postmodernism.
You know, I had a podcast episode with Mark Cameron Boyd, and it was very interesting because he is an art theorist, and we were talking about how where are we in now? You know, how would art theorists label our generation now? Are we in the post-post-postmodern? Like, are we going to just keep compartmentalizing things into categories? And, you know, what if this is just a intellectual exercise that doesn't really go anywhere? I mean, I think the distinction has split to, this is my opinion from what I've seen, not from what people want it to be, but what's going on, regardless of their feelings. But bird's eye view, what's going on in the gallery scene there are people who are have different standards in depending on the type and style that they're producing from. So, you know, if we look at certain times of art history, you'll look at neo-expressionism, let's say. During that time, it was a matter of painting under these parameters. You know, that's for a higher success rate because that's the vibe of the culture. Now you're at this point where all those tools are available and they're all shown at different times. It's almost like we're in like a time travel box because there's too many options. And I think it's a matter of depending on where. Like if I show at Studio Gallery, you better have some really strong figurative work. You know, if you're going to show at not necessarily the Hillier, but some of these galleries in D.C., you got to make strong abstract work. So I think their band-aid has been ripped. It's really a matter of, you know, where people's psyches are, you know. And luckily there is, you know, groups like the alt-right. Like these, there are underground groups that are starting to call things as horse manure because they are. Because that question you asked me of where do things stand, you know, between modernism and postmodernism, it's a really tricky thing because it's difficult. It really is difficult to answer that because we're going in so many directions. It's
kind of a stereotype that modern art is like leftist, but there is sort of a tradition of modern art of the right. If you look at like Italian futurism, like Marinetti, Wynhan sure. Lewis, and even Salvador Dali.
Well, I mean, let me be real. I mean, maybe this is my right-winged Asian-ness talking, but I like their work a lot more in a way. And don't get me wrong, I'm not putting down work that has been produced out of that sort of ideology. While my predilections are very clear now that you've spoken to me, I do think that they're all, again, art is about language, not about beauty. Some work might be more beautiful, but it's about whether or not the person is fully committing to this sort of direction. You know, whether they really convey that experience. Are you living in that, you know, moment? Are they pulling you in? Do they do it successfully? That's the whole point of a critique, right? So, yes, but what you're getting at in terms of, so we can be more specific and descriptive, is that those artists you just brought up, the futurists or the surrealists, they did not completely let go of the figure. You notice that?
The futurist specialize more in like architecture and machinery.
Yes, but that's my point. They have that structure. They don't fully let go because, and people might look at that as a weakness because don't get me wrong, there is a certain kind of respect that I have for people who are able to just fully let go. But in the same breath, a lot of times that can just be a lazy person that's conning you, right? I'll be real with you because I guess what I'm saying is a better question that will answer this is, how can you define and respect an abstract painter? And now I can answer that, but that's my question to you. If you look at an abstract artist, what makes this person produce a great piece of abstract work, you know?
And how would you define that?
So that's where it gets tricky, because here's the thing.
Because the thing is, like, I'm a very visual person. I can look at something and see what works or not. And I'm also able to talk about ideas. But with painting, sometimes it's one of those things, like, you have this visual experience by looking at a painting, but then when you talk about what works and you get to the kind of critique level, that's when it gets more abstract.
Yes. Here, put it this way. If a child was to try to emulate Jackson Pollock, he might be able to. But the difference is Jackson Pollock can do it 10 times in a row. A kid might have to do it 100 times, and it might turn out right once. That's one way of putting it. And what I'm essentially getting at is that there is a lack of discipline in today's leftists who are making work. And they are kind of taking the easy way out by producing work that has to do with their identity, you know, and whether it's about the struggles of being there's a lot of artists in DC that are doing the struggles of being a black person in this world. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, okay. What about like, I'll tell you, Robert, from what I've heard and from what I've seen of your work, you're talking about art in terms of the process as an artist, which, you know, believe me, I love. And we can probably, if we were both in a studio, we'd probably have a great time critiquing together. But what I'm saying is I'm trying to communicate to those people who do not make art, who don't know art. They're looking at them as gateways for experiences almost. And they're just looking at them as conversation starters. And I sort of made that leap and to understanding how people who do not produce art look at art. So I know where you're coming from, but I try to look at it from that perspective as well. Because probably the most of your audience, like, I don't know, maybe I'm being presumptuous, but I don't know if they paint or not, you know?
I was talking to a friend who had on the show, Ray Sawhill. He was a cultural critic for a Newsweek, and he's known a lot of people in the art world and a lot of wealthy people. And he was talking about, like, what defines, like, good taste. And what are you saying? Most of the wealthy people he's known and people in the so-called cultural elite is they define, like, a good taste and consensus, what other people in their social circles around them see as good taste, rather than developing their own individual strong aesthetic standards.
So there's two ways about this, but one thing is, there's your gut. And I'm going to first emphasize this because I know it's at a very instinctual level, but I do not undermine anyone's gut, and I do think that it's wrong to do that. So if I have a buddy of mine, you know, one of my friends, my best friend is a computer programmer, and whenever I go to look at art with him, I respect his opinion for whatever he thinks of the work. I don't care if he's trained or not. I do think it could be a boost, but you feel how you fucking feel. Excuse my language, right? So I think it's wrong for a lot of artists. There's a lot of artists who do this pretentious move, which is, oh, you haven't been trained in the arts and all this. Well, look, they don't have to be, okay? So I have buddies who have their views with just by how the work makes them feel. That's one level, and that's one way of looking at it. I will say, if you can trust that gut as a baseline, and then you have a historical context, and you have some basis of art theory, you're able to articulate that very sharp. And then that's kind of how it amplifies that experience. And then that kind of allows you to really communicate those ideas. And, you know, whether people agree with it or not, it's then there's this collective notion. But I do think it is a combination of how does this work make me feel? And am I able to articulate it? And that's where art theory comes in. I do look at it from a very, like, biological angle, actually, because I really don't like to make art. It sounds odd because a lot of times when people describe my work, they say it's like otherworldly or so out there, but I actually try to make it down to earth. I just happen to like that aesthetic.
One of your themes is commenting on a man's sense of ecological solidarity in the world and your work, and you also talk about Freud's oceanic awareness. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So one series I made was titled Ouroboros. And I was doing a lot of, you know, I don't want to sound so dramatic, but I was doing a lot of Zen meditation. And the one thing about Zen meditation, which is very interesting, is it's a way of experiencing what people call, you know, it's so fantasized today, but when people say enlightenment, I don't mean to make it sound like this otherworldly, uber spiritual thing. It simply means understanding that your identity is simply a system of memories. And there's a way of letting go and experiencing almost how you were born, which is how a baby feels. And the way a baby feels, according to Freud, which is what the oceanic experience is he cannot tell the difference between what he is, what he does, and what happens to him. And it's that cliche of everything being one. But I don't mean it in a very namby-pamby, like, unicorn fashion. I mean it in a sense of you just understand that everything is a system that functions together. And that's why I kind of went towards stylistically making the figure sort of imbued into the background. So there's this friction in between the figure and the ground. And that was what the series Ouroboros was about. And the Ouroboros is obviously the snake that's eating its own tail, symbolizing how life regenerates. And I was reading about, you know, a lot of Eastern philosophy in conjunction to the Westerners. And, excuse me. and they understood that, you know, it's like the man who lets go of his ego before he dies is a man who dies happy. And I do think that's important, because a lot of Westerners don't understand this concept of you can die happily. Not by, obviously, I don't mean that in the sense of walking towards something suicidal. I mean that when death comes, there's a time to die. It's very seasonal. And that's something that the East has understood that the West has not. And while I am a Westerner above all else, and I love this country based on the sociological parameters, the maintenance of civilization that this country has is amazing. But in terms of understanding transience, this country, they could do a little bit of work on that.
Do you know of the West Coast cartoonists like Tim Biscup and the whole lowbrow art movement that happened in the past 20 years? I kind of really love their art.
I know of it. I didn't really delve into it, but I can see why you kind of made that correlation. I mean, they're that wasn't my main influence, but I see where you're going.
Well, because I have I love lowbrow art and vinyl. I was all into the designer toys. I have them all over the place. Books like Vinyl Will Kill and Juxtapose magazine have always been kind of on my bookshelf, and that's something I've always, if I was to continue into fine arts, you know, stuff like from that I would make. But right now it's all over the media through cartoons, simply that's on the West Coast and it affects the animation industry and it's there, and that there's some cross between, you know, hip cartoon shows like Adventure Time and everything on Fredulator Studios have a huge impact in the whole popular culture, even though that art probably 10 prior 20 years ago was considered to be lowbrow art, which I find very interesting. And it's something compared, you know, looking at your art, it just reminded me of some of Tim Biscup's latest art. I don't know.
Wow. Well, you know, I think one reason why the what would be, you know, labeled as lowbrow art is really common today is because the internet, and how meme culture has changed how we use pictography, and it's a matter of our attention spans change with the technology that we live under. You know, Marshall McLuhan's notion of medium, the medium being the message. It's, you know, it's almost like he had a crystal ball in his, in his belly or something, because I don't know how he predicted all this so accurately, but people's attention span does work with that art style you're talking about, because we want it kind of quick and we want it almost blunt and direct, you know?
And well, some actually, of you know, the online, like, illustrations, like the Vaporwave, some of them are pretty advanced. Like the meme culture kind of pop art stuff.
Vaporwave?
It's like online illustrations.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, isn't it that like hologram kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah, like holograms, 80s nostalgia, like some Roman bust, Japanese influence, all kind of collaged together.
Yeah, but you know, that's where art goes into like it's not even, it's all technology art, which is a whole different world that I'm not so familiar with, to be honest. I mean, I got to be real with you. Like, I like it, but I love paint. I mean, I've been offered to do illustrations by companies, and they were gonna, you know, have me do technology and all. But I'm like I got to use paint and pen, and that's my niche.
So I'm getting started as an artist, like starting to. I've had a few gallery shows. What is your advice to artists just getting started who are looking to make a living as an artist? I know it's pretty tough.
Yeah. So one thing you're going to have to do is let me give some like identity reflection on this. I know. I just talked about how you shouldn't do the whole identitarian politics, but I mean it in a very different light. If I was to say, oh, you know, Robert Venosa's work, and you look at his work, you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's what he does. If you were to look at, you know, Picasso, obviously, you say, oh, yes, he does the whole cubism notion and all this. If I say Jean-Michel Basquiat, you'll say, oh, yes, he does this. And in other words, there is a trend. And the, you know, that was just a macro of it. But the microcosm would be you want to kind of develop a consistent style so that you can be identified. Mm. So if a person says, oh, Arthur Cohen Lee, yeah, he does those figures. And, you know, but if I'm suddenly doing something way different, that'll be okay because it shows my, you know, my understanding of like other, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a whole rule of artists in the studio. You can do whatever you want in the studio. Businessmen outside of the studio. You need to have a marketable palette. It's easier for people to compartmentalize you like that. It just works better that way. And also, you know what? There's so much vastness that, like, don't get me wrong. I'll paint landscapes on my own time, but I don't really show that work. Mm. Like, I really sell myself as a figure artist because, you know, you want to do one thing in a way. I don't mean to limit anyone, but it tends to have a higher success rate if you look at some of the artists in the East Coast, at least. You know, if I mention Jeff Huntington, that's what he does too. Or if I mention Janice Goodman, hers is it's all abstract. It's almost like it's all fluidity. You see what I'm saying? Like, there is a consistency that does help both the curator.
You see that consistency in my work? I showed you some pictures of it.
Yeah, I saw some of your work, and your work has an honesty to it. Although subject matter wise, now remember, there's formalism, and then there's contextualism. Now, depending on the degree of the gallery, that's going to really change. Now, I've shown in many different kind of galleries, and there's galleries they don't care about what sort of commentary you're doing. You know, they just want to show great art, which I love. You know, there's a lot of times I come across beautiful work, but if there's like a, you know, in many respects a more serious gallery that wants to really show your work, they're going to want some philosophical context, because they want the full package. They want to have both work that is aesthetically stimulating and consistent, while at the same breath having content, you know, content driven qualities that make people reflect while being entertained in a way. And that's something that needs to be honest within you, and that's where the fulfillment can grow in, because it needs to be something that you do find stimulating and you do find to be that resonates with you. The only problem is if you're like me, where it goes against the grain. You know, it goes against the grain with other artists. But don't get me wrong, I'm doing fine.
I like this might sound like a cliche too, but I always love Asian art. And whenever I have the chance, you know, at the Philadelphia Art Museum has a fantastic collection of Japanese art of the past, but even some of the more, I guess the term lowbrow is okay. There's some pop galleries in Philadelphia, which come and go for like 3 years until they move to a different destination. They have up and coming artists, which is very anime based influence and mostly is digital on print. And just to say, like, I know you prefer paint, but today we live in a revolution where you can go to the art store, buy this like little $100 pad, install a program on your MacBook Pro, and then just do these cartoons online, whether it be hentai or porn, or maybe just Tumblr art. And then supposedly, maybe some kid's going to ejaculate on that and masturbate, or it's going to be considered fine art. right? And that means it has an aesthetic power. And I'm actually serious about that, where some of these Tumblr artists...
I see what you're saying. I mean, I have given a serious thought. Actually, you mentioned a lot of points. One, which is, Eastern art is seriously underrated. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, I really have thought about going digital. I'm still tug of war about that, just because...
You have to be maybe I'm
getting old.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know what? The reason why I actually stopped the physical paint world is simply because all my homework and learning about English language was on a computer. And I basically, you become a computerized world, and the computer becomes our second brain we bring everywhere. And we're kind of ruled by that, unfortunately. Yet again, it is the culture of the next few years. I don't know.
I mean, that's, again, Marshall McLuhan's quote of how man becomes the sex organs for the machine. You know, it's the medium really is the message. I mean, it's crazy, but yeah, maybe I'm just old fuck in that aspect.
So I actually discovered you via the interview you did with Luke Ford. He's been a guest many times in this show.
Wonderful.
How did you meet him?
Luke is really cool. It's fun. So Luke... we had a really awesome conversation, and what I find so refreshing about him was that, you know, he was willing to touch base on topics that a lot of people, even in my peer group, and we're a bunch of, you know, me and my buddies, we're very straight up, but he was, you know, he's willing to touch upon topics in this very nonchalant manner that I found refreshing, and specifically
nothing. He'll talk about any topic. Nothing's taboo.
Yes, and it's really rare. I don't find many people like that. I do that as well, but not in the same way he does. I do it just because I simply believe if you put anything underground, it festers. So I believe you put everything on the table. I do it for ethical reasons. He just does it just like because it's like his psychological makeup is that way. You know what I mean? But we had a great conversation about eugenics, and it's something that's so frowned upon, but the reality is the very fact that you have a reproductive strategy, unconscious or otherwise, is a eugenic basis to it.
Oh yeah. You talked about the like a K versus R selection theory with Luke.
That's something that is most popular because Stefan Molyneux, but it really is a, you know, I don't mean to anthropomorphize animal behavior into human, you know, human mating patterns, but the reality is it's a very eerie synchronicity that the very fact that if you look at the way conservatives, you know, the reproductive strategy of conservative thinking versus more leftists, it fits the script and it surprises you. And are you guys both familiar with the you know, RNK selection theory?
Yeah, Philip Rushton, I was thinking about.
Philip Rushton, did he coin it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just, it's really interesting. It really is. I mean, like, I've always noticed that. And because what it entails is essentially all this political back and forth tug of war that we've been seeing is gene wars. It's psychological gene warfare.
There's a picture of you online with Mayo Yiannopoulos, actually, and he had a recent art gallery about doing, I guess, quote unquote, Republican or right wing art composed to what you're talking.
Oh, but he did do something of Milo did this thing where he was bathing in pig blood, and he was kind of doing evoke like offend Muslims.
Yeah, I was
it's
not
kind
there.
Of ironic okay. about it is it is.
I
of,
wish I was. I would have. I would have like jumped in there with him. And probably got shot.
Yeah, how do you define that in K&R strategy?
So here's the whole problem today. Performance art is a serious hit and miss today. Some people, like there's a peer of mine, he's phenomenal. You know, my friend, I'm not going to name him because I would have asked him first, you know, out of respect, but he's a Brazilian artist friend of mine and he's phenomenal. We don't agree with almost anything, actually. But his work speaks for itself. There are performance artists who are amazing. You know, I have professors who are amazing, but I've seen some performance art, and it's crap. You know, so Milo's Pig Blood, because it's Milo, and what it kind of entails being this very public figure that's, you know, beloved on one hand, but then ignorantly hated on the other. I think that added a different, obviously, it added a complete different spin to it. Look, I wasn't a fan of the work aesthetically, but just because the whole situation of it being a right-wing show and how that's so rare, I didn't mind.
You talked to Luke about the alt-right. Do you identify with the alt-right or more sort of like mainstream conservatism?
That's, you know what? I've been really thinking about that.
Alt-left is a good term. Alt-left.
Pilliter, do you want to briefly explain what the alt-left is to him?
Well, we've actually...
Yeah, that's a new phenomenon.
The supposedly alt-left is a term that kind of Rabbit on his own www.altleft.com website he has, where he explains it as the left-wing faction of the alt-right, where it's not about Hitler fetishism, but rather about making basics about, okay, if the left truly means what it means and it actually is quite beneficial, how can you have like normal healthy lives and still be glad to be consider yourself left-wing, or at least what are things, values, which are left-wing?
Another thing about Rabbit is that he's successful. He's created his own unique aesthetic. He's really into like the...
That's interesting.
Mid-century space age and like 70s futurism.
Well, my whole take on it is, you know, I appreciate what the alt-right is doing in terms of the dissidents against the rabid behavior of leftists. So... In that sense, like, I mean, my only thing with the alt-right is on the fringes, as Milo actually puts it, there are some extremists that, you know, are that might make the whole movement kind of almost, you know, that kind of throw off the movement. I mean, in terms of where I stand, I'm more of a constitutional conservative, but I do I'm not like against the alt-right, actually. I actually think they are currently have a function in our culture right now. Now, in terms of where they will stand, you know, in terms of the long term, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do think that they have a place right now. You know, now whether they give Trump insurmountable amount of power just by keep pushing him as this demigod, that could be a... I don't know if that's the clearest way to look at things, but I appreciate the alt-right for what they have done to the left, uh-huh. You know, because it's forced them to get a taste of their own medicine. And, but I do believe that you do not adopt and practice the evil that you deplore. And I'm not saying they have, but in many cases they do these, identity attacks sometimes.
Yep.
And don't get me wrong, I understand why they do, because they're usually right. That's why I said that I'm not against them, in a sense, because they're right. But I do think that they should be the bigger man in a way. And although that they would say their argument to that would be to just take the punch in the face. And again, this is why I can't say I'm against them, but I don't find them fashionable for my, you know, view. And they might look at that as being cuck based, but they probably are not, you know, 6 feet in.
I find I have a very artistic and fictional ideology that I just made up, and I've been actually putting it on my YouTube channel. The word I use is Asian Aryanism, and it's this ideal that supposedly flirts with the alt-right, but it's not it's not really alt-right, but the ideal is supposedly, well, accordingly, the whole Richard Spencer thing is, he said, we're going to have a white ethno-state, and it's going to be there, and there's these fanatics on the alt-right saying the white ethno-state, like they're Zionist Jews. I have this argument where it's like, okay, well, why not there be a white male, Asian female, Asian male, white female ethnostate right next to the white ethnostate, and that could be an Asian American community but with alt-right basis, but have these very eccentric viewpoints. It's kind of like being Asian American but you're alt-right, but you don't exactly agree with the whole Hitler fetishism, and it's more based upon this.
You know, it's very fascinating. I mean, I can kind of jive with that a little bit more.
It works so well, because what happens is I tell about it, people are like, you're gonna go to the gas chambers now.
Well, of course that's what they say. But I guess what I'm telling you is that that's not going to take off. But I will say that, you know, okay, so the East is a shame culture. The West is a guilt culture.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is that Asians are not going to pump themselves up as like a master race or anything of that sort, even though the history of the Mongols was had this kind of incentive. But even so, for some reason, they're not going to say it. But it's funny because, you know, technically speaking, if we want to look at statistics and what's on paper, we could just – Asians are the ones who make the most money. We're the ones seen as the least hostile. We our IQs are generally 15 to 20 points higher than white people. I mean, we could make that argument, but that's not going to happen with Asians. Our culture is, we, you know, we like to just kind of be quiet and civil about it.
What Luke was saying about like whites and Asians is he said Asians have higher IQs and are harder working, but they're also more inhibited. But Luke's point was the people who are the most successful in our society. It's a combination of a high IQ, but also a high level of being uninhibited. Would you say there's accuracy to that?
There's plenty of accuracy to that, which is why the first thing I do when I meet my Asian peers, and this is where we're going to more of the genetic hormonal study, is, I mean, I tell them to lift, go lift some weights. Because what happens is it'll elevate their testosterone, and it'll make them less inhibited. And with
that
high IQ,
same thing, actually.
No, seriously, I advise all Asian men to go lift some weights. And I know this sounds weird, but it's going to elevate their testosterone, and it's going to make them almost in a way unstoppable. This is why I make more money than all my friends.
It's funny because it's, you know, it's weird because there's this whole thing going around where it's like, well, Asian males fail at the multicultural and diversity game. They're just disliked everywhere. There's just weak and feminine Yukio Mishima men that nobody, and they're going to be like Elliot Rodgers, and they're going to shoot up the school. And it's this really strange, like, but it's like, it's not telling you not to be like, do masculine things like lifting weights. And I lift weights too. And it's improved my masculine character and my confidence. And so like, if there were more like Asian men doing that, I think there would be much more harmony between, I don't know. I think it works well. And with the whole going back on the whole Asian Aryan thing, it's kind of like, it's not necessarily, it's not like I'm saying neo-Nazi Asians. It's not that all, or I'm not advocating some weird
oh,
race
like
mixing
that,
thing.
What's the Japanese?
Robert's like, fuck these two fucking Asians.
No, it has nothing.
Well, let me say something, man. Let me say something. It's actually interesting because if we're talking about what is the light of these alternative groups we're talking about on the right side, it's the same thing. Okay, it's different degrees and how and different fashions of conservatism. And one thing that I find funny is there's this whole argument that the left truly has bought. They have completely submitted to this idea that higher intelligence equates to more diversity and liberal towards different perspectives, as if it's, you know, it's a smarter thing to do. And there's all these articles pronouncing that, you know, conservatism is low IQ thinking, you know, by all these bullshit writers, you know, Huffington Post, Vox, et cetera, et cetera. But it's funny because if that really is the case, look at where the highest IQ places are versus the lowest IQ. If you look at sub-Saharan Africans, their IQ average is 85 to 95. And then by that argument, they should be extremely conservative to the point where they do not want to mate with anyone else outside their, you know, gene pool. Or if you look at the highest IQ, which is Japan, average IQ being 115 to 125, they are highly conservative culture. You know, they're the most conservative culture in the world. So this whole idea that the left is pushing that, you know, IQ, low IQ equates to conservative thinking is just a straw man. It's just their way of not having to address the reality that
in
they
a
maybe
way,
just aren't.
I'm arguing that I think the left and the whole multicultural and diverse paradigm where whites are going out and marrying non-whites, particularly whites will choose Asian wives, and it has accidentally created a pan-Asian American community in most major metropolitan cities. Now in Philadelphia, there is quite a sprawl of white male Asian females, and they all go to the same places. That's vegan restaurants, art galleries, punk rock shows, and the strange stuff white people like with Asian fusions happening. It's already there in existence, but they're very quiet about it. And so when I say Asian Aryan, I'm not saying Japanese neo-Nazi. I'm saying it's here, it's there. What are you supposed to do if you have a alt-right takeover? What are you supposed to do with these people? Just throw them into the side? It's like this funny thing that's... you point it out like stuff white people like. It's more like stuff Eurasian people like, but I don't know.
Well, you know what? There actually is a I see what, like, culturally, it actually might, you know, there could be a, in a very selfish gene, in a very fat, you know, I'm being fashionable in a selfish gene way. It could be good if they really spoke out, but in a financial way, it's good that they don't speak out. Mm-hmm. Because what that means is, that means they can go right under the radar, right to the top. No, I'm serious. I know, yeah. This sounds odd, but this is the same reason why.
I understand too. I can.
Yeah. I mean, it works. You know, it's like, let's not rock the boat. Just let me just make sure I get to this position where I get more money.
Yeah, and that's what I'm doing. And that's why it's the ultimate troll method.
I think that's true with Asians in general. They tend to be politically fairly centrist. You don't see them as much like on the far right or the far left.
Usually, yeah, which is really strange because if you look at the culture, at least, I mean, I can speak 100% for Koreans. I know this is true for Chinese and Japanese as well, having dated a lot of them. But the reality is we are incredibly conservative in our lifestyle, though. We are family-oriented, education-based, entrepreneurial. You know, we have all the fundamental tenets that are advocated by conservative thinking. And they just, you know, they just don't really as far as I can tell, the reason why so many Asians voted for the Democratic Party for this election, for instance.
Well, I looked up the voter statistics for California. Like, if you looked, I looked at like Koreatown in LA.
Yeah.
And like the Chinese parts of the Bay Area, and they were overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton.
That's my point. The reason why is because they have bought this notion of, you know, as if you vote, voting Republican is voting for a white genetic lineage, which isn't the point. I mean, we're talking about values and principles here. If we want to talk about genetics, that's a complete different, that's a different conversation is the point. You know, that's a different topic. You know, we're talking about parameters. That's what policy is. Parameters for us to have the opportunity at an equal level. Now, I don't really believe in, you know, the whole tug of war is basically this. Leftists, they want equal outcome. Conservatives, they want equal opportunity. They understand there is a reality that you can't just have everything baseline, because what that does is it neglects those who have made good choices in life for those who have made bad choices. So the person who dropped out of high school, had 3 kids, left their man, and still wants a 6-figure income complaining, they think that they should have everything that a person who decided to stay home, save their money, wants to build a family, which is why they're working so hard. Somebody with that kind of ethic should have the same results? Not a chance.
I mean, I think, but it's gotten, the economy has gotten to the point where you actually have people, a lot of people, it's more complex than that, because you have a lot of people, they basically play by the rules. They work hard, go to college, take out like 100,000 student loans, and they're still like struggling.
The whole student loan thing is a whole different thing too, because I don't mean to walk away from that topic. What I'm saying is that, you know, school is a very different thing today. I mean, when I was in college, I had to pretty much develop a bunker mentality, because there was such, it was so distasteful. You know, it's
I just graduated college a few days ago, and I'm getting my double major in a few weeks. But I understand, this whole year, my last year was just sweat and just like typical. Like, I'm the student A plus guy. I have to get a high GPA in my grades, but I'm looking to go to grad school. But at the same time, it was just a sacrifice of my day, and it's just like something kills me inside where I know it's not right. And I don't mean to say, like, I originally did Asian studies, and Asian studies was fantastic, and I loved it. Maybe it's because when you're around people similar to yourself or something, you understand. But I was at a very private school that was like, I seem to notice that when there's a room full of white girls, I'm talking about white girls, not white men, they seem to talk about social justice and far left ideals. But when you're in a contradiction class where it's like more laid back, let's say a bunch of black men and white men, it's more like about culture. And then when you're in a whole room of Asians or Chinese or, you know, it's about math and doing your work and discipline. So it, really the race does affect the classroom environment. And my last year was just this weird, weird political indoctrination they're trying to get through me. I just didn't.
But you know, you're ignoring the main component that you just said, which yes, all that is prevalent, but you're also forgetting to mention how gender does as well. I mean, let's be honest, like the person who's making the most hubbub of all this identitarian victimizing are white women, democratic white women.
That's true. I mean, that's when the Trump victory happened, I noticed the reactions, like, most of the people the most upset were white women, not Mexicans.
Yes,
that's right. And you know what? There's a this is where I got into a little bit of trouble, but it's out there, whatever. And you know, my views of this is there's a understand the difference between general talk and universal. I'm being general here, just for the sake of taking the conversation forward. And what we find is that, generally speaking, women will vote their biological imperative. And what I mean by that is they're usually liberal. And it's so funny because Ann Coulter has been saying this forever. She's been saying that I sincerely believe women shouldn't vote because women will vote towards what they organically feel, which is more liberal tendencies towards what is more fair and cutting out the competitive aspect to it, therefore kind of neglecting the free market aspect of it, which de-incentivizes you know, free market masculinity and creativity. And nobody looks at it from that angle because they want to be inclusive and talk about all the, you know, making everyone feel equal, even though the reality is, you know,
it's not.
Some people are better at things.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and I can understand that.
That's what my solo was actually talking about. The fact that this culture that we live in trivializes and mocks everything, all things that are men, all things that are hyper masculine, and they try to make it look like an insecurity without understanding that thing they're trying to make look as toxic or patriarchal is why we're able to talk about it. The only reason why we're here and exploring alternative states in our psyche is because we got to this position due to these principles that got us here. And they're almost neglecting the masculine because they don't want to face the reality, which is that, hey, man, the shit works.
Do you think using art to get across a lot of these ideas is more effective than talking about it? It's kind of like, I think it was Andrew Breitbart who had that kind of a quote that, like, politics is downstream of culture.
What I have found is art is more disarming. And, I mean, no, let me put that better, because you can definitely talk about it. There's nothing that, like, put it this way. I think there's the closest thing to rape I have seen, and I am saying a rape joke, too bad, is Ben Shapiro talking to a leftist. That is the closest thing I've seen. Having said that, what I do think is, you know, a way of not having to talk to them but forcing them to reflect, because art is – art hits that part of the brain of reflection. That's the point. So if you're trying to communicate something without having to go through all that, that's where I've done it successfully many times. You know, this show has changed people's views on how boyish behavior is pathologized. That is reality. I mean, I teach these kids, you know, and normal boyish behavior is pathologized because it's looked upon as rowdy without understanding that, no, this is how boys bond. They fuck with each other. Like we're trying to just mess with the whole – we're trying to pretend like the genetic aspect isn't there, which is just so absurd. You know? It's just – it's really
like all the men I know are super feminine. And like I said, especially in school, all my white close friends, in ways of being feminine, they have to have like – Like I said, the white feminist girls won't have them because they are too feminine. So in a way, I think this might sound a little silly, but in Asian studies class, all the white guys would have Asian girlfriends simply because I think that was a perfect union of understanding how emasculated our culture is. And I wish some of my white friends you know, would lift weights and be more masculine, you know?
I'll tell you what, man. I mean, I always say this joke every time. So my buddies are, I'm not saying we're all cavemen, but you know, we're dudes. Like we all do judo, we all grapple, we're wrestlers, we weightlift. Okay. But I mean, we're not total meatheads, but a lot of times I'll just look at these guys and I'll just be like, these men need fucking steaks and squats. Like, what is going on? I mean, it's like, I understand that you're trying to be sensitive towards people's feelings, but it's getting to the extent that you need to sacrifice how you feel yourself, mm-hmm. you know? And if it gets to that point, oof, you might as well clip your balls off, man.
I mean, the one thing I've been always doing right now is I just lift weights in my garage, because my dad was he lifted weights. And so that's kind of been I just run and lose calories and lift weights and try to keep my diet. But at the same time, I understand too, like, I used to do wrestling back in middle school, but then there's a point in time where we now don't have the technology that everyone could do judo or wrestling. And it seems to me that it's so much easier to go and have a McDonald's cheeseburger, watch Hang Tie, and then wish for a girlfriend with blue hair. And it's really this, I don't mean to say degenerate culture, but it's unhealthy, and we need to have values that are
interesting. Because one thing I've been doing a lot of commentary on is beauty. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, you know, many different standards of interpreting it, which is one thing you mentioned, which is how, you know, the average woman today, there's a study the Washington Post published, weighs 160 pounds, which is what the average man weighed in 1960. And listen, I mean, this affects men too, but women are getting a lot more fat than them.
Yeah.
And it matters because as men, we are the visual creatures. You know, we think in visual systems. We think, we judge each other visually. And that's why, like you said, this whole blue hair thing, it's really distasteful how we're trying to make it like it's all about beauty has been it's condensed to a feeling beautiful. No. You either do it because you've worked on it or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's ironic because as an artist, as someone who's aesthetically driven, you should know that more than anyone else.
100%. I mean, look, I know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but based on how they carry their cover, I'm comfortable doing that because, quite frankly, your cover, you know, it shows the collective decisions of how you decide that it shows the decision-making of your history, you know, and, you know, especially with this weird body positivity, you're fat shaming if you talk about how I'm a sphere and I've green haired, septum pierced, you know, all this armpit. I mean, what is going on with that? You know, and that's because of feminist ideology, man. It really is. And I do think that, like, the third wave feminism has ruined it, the most important relationship on the planet between men and women.
Yes.
And
we are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Arthur Kwan Lee for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Hey, Robert, thank you so much for having me on. I mean, both of you are you guys are cool as hell. I mean, if you're ever in DC, just let me know. We'll grab a beer or something.
Okay.
Or if you're in LA or up in Philly with that.
Yeah. Philadelphia.
Hey, Philly, huh? Okay. LA or Philly, I'll definitely give you guys a shout out. Yeah, you guys can find me at arthurquonley.com and get your balls back, boys. I'm just kidding.
All right. Got it.
All right. Thanks, guys.